Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an examination of the diplomatic track towards disarming Syria of its chemical weapons underway at the United Nations Security Council. Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was America's top diplomat at the United Nations mission in Afghanistan, who negotiated the end of the war in Croatia and served with the UN in East Timor, joins us to discuss the wrangling between Russia, who is opposed to Chapter 7, and most of the permanent five, plus the UN Secretary General, who want to have the stick while offering the carrot. Then, following the latest gun massacre that followed a weekend in America in which 57 people were shot, we will look into how difficult it is to get mental health care while it is increasingly easy to get guns. Carolyn Reinach-Wolf, a partner in a law firm where she is the director of the firm's mental health law practice, joins us to discuss the legal issues involved in protecting the rights of the mentally ill and how they can be balanced against the need to keep guns out of the hands of the mentally ill, given that the well-armed shooters behind the massacres at the Navy Yard, Virginia Tech, Aurora, and Sandy Hook all had mental health issues. Then finally, we'll examine the latest U.S. Census Bureau report on poverty in America with Stephen Pimper, the author of A People's History of Poverty in America, who is a professor at the Columbia University School of Social Work. We will discuss how, unlike most advanced democracies who are funding programs to end poverty, the United States House of Representatives has cut funds and is planning on cutting more to further impoverish and deny food to the 22% of the nation's children who go to bed hungry and the 15% of the population who live in poverty. And joining us now is Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was America's top diplomat at the United Nations mission in Afghanistan before being recalled over a conflict on how to respond to that country's fraud-ridden presidential elections. A former U.S. ambassador to Croatia in 1995, he was the co-mediator and principal architect of the agreement that ended the war in Croatia. And from 2000 to 2001, he served with the United Nations in East Timor. He's also a professor of national security strategy at the National War College and is currently a senior diplomatic fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. His books include Unintended Consequences, How the War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies, and The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Peter Galbraith.
Well, good to be with you.
And obviously, meetings are going on Tuesday in the Security Council at the United Nations, trying to hammer out how to proceed. Two things, of course, at least the shadow, I guess, that's hanging over the Russian position is the release of the UN report on who was responsible for the August 21st chemical weapons attack in Damascus. And it's pretty the evidence is overwhelming that it was a Syrian regime. And yet Foreign Minister Lavrov is saying we have serious reason to suggest that it was a provocation by the rebels. So are the Russians going to sort of drop that one, or did they just trap themselves into this situation?
I'm not sure that I can predict what the Russians will do, but if you pressed me, I would say that they are likely to keep on their line, but say it. With ever less conviction and ever more softly, because I think at this stage, after that UN report, they must realize that it is an extreme likelihood that it was the regime that used the weapons, not the rebels.
So in terms of the wrangling that's going on in the UN Security Council in these Tuesday meetings, the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, is basically saying that we need a Chapter 7 under the UN Charter. It's the most effective way to deal with threats to international peace and security. And in reality, we need clear guidelines under Chapter 7. The Russians are opposed to Chapter 7. Their compromise position is, well, if Assad reneges on the agreement, then maybe you can invoke Chapter 7, but they don't want it up front. So is this a deal breaker?
It shouldn't be a deal breaker. And in fact, I think that the importance of this issue could be overstated. First, let's look at what are the two sides really concerned about. The Russian concern is that if they put this into a binding Security Council resolution, which is what a Chapter 7 resolution is, that the Americans will use any breach to justify not only taking military, well, to to justify taking military action, and military action which could continue indefinitely or continue until Assad is overthrown. I think the Russians feel very burned by what happened in Libya, where they joined in authorizing use of force to protect the people of Benghazi, and NATO not only took action to protect Benghazi, but then continued its military campaign to overthrow Gaddafi, and then once Gaddafi was overthrown, the NATO strikes continued until he was tracked down and killed. So they are concerned that if they give the Americans an inch, the Americans will take a mile. Now, President Obama and the U.S. administration, they obviously want Syria's obligations to be mandatory. And also, from the American point of view, there's a certain amount of face to be saved, having been moving toward military strikes, then having this Russian initiative come up. They don't want their domestic critics to say, well, they were soft, and so they'd like to say, well, yes, it's a mandatory resolution. But the reality is that Syria is going to be very difficult to disarm Syria in the middle of a civil war, so that we can expect some of these weapons to be destroyed. Others will be inaccessible. We don't know whether the Syrians will cheat or not, but frankly, chemical weapons that are hidden away are basically unusable, because the moment you take them out and want to use them, if you have large numbers that you've hidden away and you're not in compliance, when you take them out to deploy them, everybody will see this with the intelligence resources that a number of countries now have, and that will be a justification for a strike. And if you take them out and use just one or two, it again would invite a military response without actually accomplishing any military purpose that you might want to use the chemical weapons for. So as a practical matter, Syria's chemical weapons will be unusable, whether it's a Chapter 7 resolution or Chapter 6.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was America's top diplomat at the United Nations mission in Afghanistan before being recalled over a conflict on how to respond to that country's fraud-ridden presidential elections. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Croatia and also served with the United Nations in East Timor. And his latest book is The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. But, of course, the agreement, which in many ways seemed to have gotten President Obama off the hook in terms of a very, very unlikely passage of the war resolution in the Congress and tremendous resistance from the American public, this deal obviously is, to that extent, is helpful for the administration. But on the other hand, neither the Russians nor the United States and its allies are in any way restrained from supplying their combatants on both sides. So that's what's extraordinary about this deal, is that it's in no ways bringing about peace. It's not ending a war. In fact, most of the 110,000, 120,000 people that have been killed so far have been killed by conventional weapons, and we're going to be pouring them in, and so are the Russians.
Yes. I mean, that is an extremely important point, which is that chemical weapons are horrific, but they have killed 1 or 2% of the people who have died in this war. And this war will be continuing. And to some degree, all the attention that has gone to the chemical weapons issue has diverted attention from the horrors of the war itself and from the necessity of finding some kind of solution. You're also right to say that this diplomatic agreement was a godsend for President Obama. He faced an absolute foreign policy fiasco, where he had asked for authority for Congress for military strikes that almost certainly was not going to be forthcoming, where the United States was looking like it was going to be acting alone. Not even the British were joining in. And in saying that the U.S. could act alone, President Obama was beginning to sound like George Bush 10 years before on the eve of the Iraq invasion. What instead, and furthermore, had we then gone ahead and acted, it's not clear it would have had any impact on Syria's use of chemical weapons. We couldn't actually strike the chemical weapons for fear that we would release the poison gas and kill more people. So the whole hope was that surgical strikes on Syrian targets would have some deterrence value. Instead, thanks to the Russians, and thanks also, I think, to President Obama's threats and to some rather skillful follow-up on what the Russians said, the United States has gotten much more. It has a promise from the Syrians to get rid of these weapons, a promise that will certainly compel the Syrians to get rid of at least some of the weapons. It is a promise that will make it impossible for the Syrians to actually use the weapons again without facing certain consequences. So what is in hand is something that should be much more effective in terms of preventing another use of these weapons than what might have been accomplished by a military strike.
So, Ambassador Galbraith, you've spent a lot of time in Iraqi Kurdistan, and Iraqi Kurdistan, of course, is sheltering a massive influx of refugees from Syria, Kurdish refugees, the al-Nusra Front, this group that the Saudis appear to have let in and seem to be getting the weapons and are the most effective fighting force, apparently, on the rebel side. And, of course, they essentially justify what the dictator Assad says, which is it's either me or the terrorists. So to that extent, they're a godsend to the Assad regime. I'm absolutely mystified why we weren't able to influence the Saudis into not letting all these jihadis in. But the long and the short of it is, the al-Nusra people apparently issued a fatwa against the Syrian Kurds as heretics, and they had to flee. So how do we – I mean, isn't that our main problem here in terms of taking sides, that the side that we've taken is so tainted, not that the other guy is nothing but a murderous monster?
Well, that is a problem. As this war has proceeded, the influence of Islamic extremists has increased on the opposition side, and of course the influence of moderates has correspondingly diminished. And on the government side, the government, which had actually come into office with some hope of being reformist in 2000 when the President Assad's father died, is now drenched in blood and is responsible for horrific crimes. And of course, having extremists on one side and crimes committed on the other makes it very difficult to find a political settlement. But the problem with the opposition is not just the extremists, although that is a serious problem. It is that even the moderate and democratic parts of the opposition have not been able to win any significant support from Syria's minorities. The demography of Syria is this: about 60% of the country are Sunni Arabs, but there are about 12% who are Alawites. This is a very secretive sect that uses elements of Christianity and Islam, and which is the sect of President Assad and of the top people in the military and the government, and which is considered by most Sunnis as being not Muslim or heretical. There are about 10% Christians who, like Christian minorities around the Middle East, tend to side with the people who are in power. And then about 10-12% Kurds who were brutally repressed by Assad, but who feel that the opposition, even the democratic opposition, has offered them nothing. And another 5% Druze, again, who are quite fearful of what will happen if there is a Sunni-dominated regime in Damascus. The Alawites fear that if the regime is overthrown, they'll become victims of genocide. And, of course, the more crimes that are committed by the Assad regime and by Alawite militia make that more likely. And the end result of all of this is that Assad probably has a sufficient base of support with the support of the Alawites and with the support of enough Sunnis who have benefited from the regime, and the neutrality of the Christians and Kurds and Druze, that he will not be overthrown, that he will be able to stay in office for the indefinite future. And on the other hand, though, he may not be able to win control over the entire country. So Syria is likely to look like Lebanon did all through that 15-year civil war.
And if he does lose Damascus, which of course may be the rationale for using those chemical weapons, that would be obviously a huge blow. And there is of course talk of a kind of rump Sunni state, which may well be landlocked, and the Alawites retreating to the coast. I talked the other day to Joshua Landis, a Syrian expert at the University of Oklahoma, who does a daily newsletter, Syria Comment, and he brought up a point which I thought was interesting, and given your experience in Afghanistan, I'm curious to get your response. He argued that in many ways American strategists have come to the conclusion that Afghanistan was a poison chalice, and that both the Carter and Reagan administration's proxy war bringing in the jihadis to hurt the Russians and eventually leading to them to withdraw was a mistake, and that we should have left Afghanistan in Russian hands, and that the same applies to Syria, that whatever, if the Russians win, as they seem to have played a weak hand very cleverly, while we've played a strong hand somewhat clumsily, they may end up with the poison chalice. Do you buy that theory?
No, I don't. This isn't the Cold War, and we certainly shouldn't want the Russians to end up with a poison chalice. If the people we backed in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union ended up being the people who attacked us on September 11th, and the last thing, and that didn't just disrupt the United States; it disrupted the entire world. And so the last thing we would want is some kind of terrorist reaction against the Russians. That will make for a much less stable world. So I think we all have an interest in finding a solution. Now, in terms of the future of Syria, yes, you could end up with an Alawite state along the coast, and that is almost certainly what would happen if the Assad regime were kicked out of Damascus. But I'm guessing that they will be able to hold on to enough of Damascus for the indefinite future. The Kurds in the northeast and northwest of Syria have already declared a region, and they want to have the same rights as their Kurdish brethren have in Iraq, which is to say almost complete autonomy. So the Syria that was created between the two world wars is already now disintegrating.
So what is there any other scenario between that end game and the current situation? I mean, I can't imagine these people who have suffered so many massacres and reprisals ever sitting down together, but you've been dealing with some difficult situations there, the Balkan Wars with Croatia and Serbia and Timor as well. So give us your sense in the last couple of minutes of how there could be an agreement between these two people who are murdering each other in the most bloodthirsty way.
I think it's extremely difficult. What made getting an agreement in the Balkans possible was the intervention of the United States. And what ended the Lebanese Civil War, which may be the closest parallel, was Syrian intervention. But there's no Syria to intervene in Syria, and frankly, there are no outside countries who can shape the destiny of what's going on. And that comes to another very important point. Syria really isn't a Russian client, and the Russians have very minimal influence there in terms of being able to... Yes, they were able to pressure the Assad regime to give up the chemical weapons to avoid an airstrike, but I don't think that they have the power to produce a political settlement. And frankly, the countries that are helping the opposition don't have a lot of influence on them either. I mean, what's the future of Syria is going to be determined by the events in Syria and by the balance of forces there. And unfortunately, there isn't a lot of common ground.
Well, Ambassador Galbraith, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, good talking with you, and I wish I had a more optimistic prognostication.
Well, no point in being Pollyanna-ish. It is what it is, and it's a very hideous situation. And I thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was America's top diplomat at the United Nations mission in Afghanistan before being recalled over a conflict on how to respond to that country's fraud-ridden presidential elections. A former U.S. ambassador to Croatia, in 1995, he was the co-mediator and principal architect of the agreement that ended the war in Croatia, and from 2000 to 2001 served with the United Nations in East Timor. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the paradox in America, how it is so difficult to get mental health treatment, but so easy to get guns.
That until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain in but a fleeting illusion to be pursued, but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, who is a partner in the law firm of Abrahams & Festerman, where she is the director of the firm's mental health law practice, concentrating on the areas of mental health and healthcare law. She is also the founder and president of Campus Behavioral Health Risk Consultants and is a former hospital administrator and director of hospital risk management. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carolyn Reinick-Wolf.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
And I'm interested in talking about the irony in this country that it is so difficult to get mental health care, yet so easy to get guns. And we've just had another incident of somebody that had mental health issues that was responsible for the murder of 12 people at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. And you can go back to the Virginia Tech shooting, that the shooter had mental health issues. And clearly the shooter at Sandy Hook more recently, who killed all those young school children, had mental health issues. So let's start with that question. Why is it so difficult to get mental health treatment in this country and so easy to get guns?
I think it's a matter of priority, and I think it's about who screams the loudest and who has the most clout, certainly in our national Congress. You know, it's a very strong gun lobby. It's not, unfortunately, a very strong lobby for mental health services. You know, over the years, there's been a lot of stigma, a lot of blaming. Certainly, these incidents are unfortunate, not only for the victims, certainly, but it adds to the stigma of equating, you know, mental illness with people who are violent. In fact, statistically, people with serious mental illness are more often the victims of violence than the perpetrators. But certainly, this highlights the issue of, you know, a very tragic situation, and then you go back and look, and it's somebody who has some sort of mental illness or mental health history.
So what kind of regime could be put in place? Just for a moment, imagining that the NRA doesn't exist and that we lived in a perfect world where the rights of citizens not to be murdered at their workplace was equal to the rights of citizens who feel they have constitutional right to carry firearms. So what kind of regime could you work out that would protect the rights of the mentally ill at the same time protect the broader public?
Well, mental illness is treatable. People can recover, although it's not a curable illness. And we have seen, and, you know, statistics bear it out as well as the clinical researchers, that if mental illness is treated early on, if people have insight into their illness, if they stay in treatment, if they're compliant with medications or other forms of treatment, they can be stabilized and they can, you know, work safely in the community, live and work. And so I think first and foremost, we need to shift all our priorities into funding for mental illness the same way as we fund medical illnesses, diabetes, cardiac illnesses, cancer. Not that those aren't important illnesses that need funding and attention also, but we tend not to fund and to do the adequate research we need in the mental health area. So certainly that's first and foremost, is funding for these services, not only in terms of treatment itself, but supportive services.
So would it be okay with you for a psychiatrist who's treating a patient to make some reference to, I guess it's the FBI that have the database on whether you can buy a gun? What's your sense of how that intersection can be constructed?
I think part of the problem with the gun legislation that we've seen in sort of a knee-jerk reaction, certainly after Aurora and then absolutely following the Newtown tragedy, is that we set up these systems to report people who are making certain statements or have a certain mental health history into a database. But putting a name into a database with the hope that it'll prevent someone from buying a gun doesn't address the real fundamental underlying issues that we face in this country. It doesn't provide funding. It doesn't provide support services. It doesn't provide housing. In other words, you put a name into a database, and then what? You're not addressing the core issue, which is treatment and prevention. And so putting a name in a database is something that everybody thinks is a great idea. But not only does it not provide services or any constructive assistance to people who have mental illness, it also, and this is the fear for those of us who work in this area, is that it'll chill the effect of people going for treatment. If someone goes to their mental health professional and talks about being, talks about or thinking about hurting themselves or hurting someone else, if they know they're going to get the name in a database, our concern is that they won't go for treatment or they won't talk freely. I mean, that's the whole basis for our confidentiality laws, so that people will go and seek a medical or psychiatric assistance, knowing that they're free to speak about what their issues are, and hopefully the goal is to get intervention and treatment.
Again, I'm speaking with Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, who's a partner in the law firm of Abrahams and Fensterman, where she is the director of the firm's mental health law practice. And you mentioned the Aurora shooter that I didn't mention in the opening. He, of course, pleaded guilty on the basis of mental illness. And in his case, you get the impression that the parents, and particularly the healthcare professionals at the university, where he was getting treatment, somehow dropped the ball. In the case of Sandy Hook, the mother, of course, was the first victim. The son killed the mother, but he clearly had mental health issues. Is the problem that, in effect, you're requiring those closest, the next of kin, the parents of somebody that's exhibiting mental illness, to sort of basically turn their kids in?
Well, it actually, in real life, works in reverse. I mean, the bulk of my practice is working with individuals and families and loved ones of people who have mental illness and are at a loss to not only know how to navigate through the mental health system, but have very little on the receiving end when they want to seek treatment, either themselves or for their loved ones. And so what you have is families who live with persons with this illness, who want to get assistance for them, recognize the issues, want treatment, but are either turned away because of our confidentiality laws. Basically, there's a wall that gets put up that says, we can't talk to you about any of this. There's a wall that's put up on our very strict involuntary commitment laws, so that families can't get someone hospitalized, for example, when they know they're really sick and need an acute level of care. So, in fact, families don't turn the other way. They want treatment. They want input. They want assistance. But there's so little on the receiving end of seeking that kind of treatment and assistance. The other issue that you raise is that if we can identify people in our workplaces, in our schools, in our community, of whom we are concerned, there are systems that you can set up for identifying them within the system in which you work. For example, in a workplace, we set up teams who are there to have to receive input from those closest to the individual about how they're concerned, how they're hearing things that sound a little bit unusual, for example, that are set up to acknowledge that and know how to follow up on those concerns. You can train lay people to identify what I call red flag behaviors in a workplace, on a college campus, for example, or even in a lower school. And in a very constructive, supportive way, you can take that information and triage it, know who's at most risk and what may be minimal risk, and then seek assistance for that person early on, again, before it escalates any further.
So
but we see very little of these teams. Certainly we see them rarely, if ever, in a workplace setting. We're seeing them more on college campuses. They're a very successful way to obtain information and to seek a response and a constructive input and support for people about whom we're concerned before it escalates.
So let's deal with these two hypotheticals. Red flag warnings at the workplace and red flag warnings at the home. Say your own child is exhibiting antisocial and dangerous behavior. Let's start with that. You're saying that if the parent tries to get help, they get nowhere. Is it because the only person who can flag this person is a psychiatrist, and that confidentiality laws prevent parents from getting help? Is that what you told us?
Well, it prevents them often from getting information that they may be able to use in order to get assistance for their loved one, for example. Or the involuntary commitment laws are so stringent. You know, it's basically a danger to self or others and has a mental illness. We're actually in my office drafting proposed legislation which would modify that standard to look at whether a person has a prior history where they were hospitalized and benefited from the treatment, where there's a care and treatment benefit to being in the mental health system and getting services, so that we recognize that not only do they benefit from services, but there are services available, and you know that may be the only way to get them. The same for the confidentiality laws. If we can make families and loved ones part of the treatment team, we can fall into one of the exceptions to these confidentiality laws, and that family can be part of the treatment team. They know what's going on in the home. They know what's going on in the school setting sometimes, so that we have more communication, not from a negative standpoint, but from a very positive, supportive advocacy standpoint by the people who know the individual best and see them on a daily basis.
So how much then, I mean, obviously these protections are very, very important. I mean, there have been incidents, obviously, quite common for parents to give their children drugs, and the kid just may be a spirited individual. And then you've had cases of families when there's a inheritance involved, basically trying to commit other members of the family in order to get the money. I mean, these are, they sound like Hollywood movies, I know, but they do happen in real life. And presumably the laws are in there to protect the individual against that kind of abuse. So how do you balance this out?
Well, I think the number of times that that's the case is certainly smaller than the number of times families love and care about the individual and want them to be in treatment and want it to be from a very loving and supportive perspective. But as we continue to see these tragedies unfold, I think we need, as a country, to look at how do we balance privacy and individual rights with safety and security of the community. And so there has to be some give and take here. I absolutely believe that there should be confidentiality and privacy, but clearly that hasn't worked as it sits right now, because we see so many of these incidents recently, and we also know that with the proper care and treatment and early intervention, we likely can prevent these tragedies, certainly, and also prevent people from suffering from an illness that, again, is treatable. So I think we need to look at shifting the balance, as I said, between privacy and individual rights, with now the broader safety and security of our communities at large.
So just in closing, Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, in terms of our culture, as opposed to the lack of mental health services and the easy access to guns, which is the recipe for the kind of continuing massacres that we have in this country, as a culture, movies, et cetera, television, you can't escape a television or a movie without a gun being pointed at you. And I think young people in this country grow up with an idea that guns solve problems as opposed to create tragedies. And there's also an association with guns and manliness. I come from a culture in Australia where anybody who pulls a gun or a knife in a fight is considered an abject coward. But in this culture, you're a hero if you have a gun. Is that something that we should be addressing?
Absolutely. I think we have become very sensitized to the violence, the video games, the constant bombardment of tragedies or of shootings, you know, over and over, the internet certainly. So I think our young people have become very sensitized to the violence. I think you're right. I think guns have kind of been romanticized in movies or in games and so on. And I think we need to begin to look very hard at that and come back to the reality of what guns are. They hurt people. They kill people. Not only the individual who is hurt or maimed or killed, but I think we also need to start talking about what does it do to the survivors. We don't talk about what about those families that are now faced with a loss of their loved one or a paralyzed loved one or a compromised loved one. We need to, again, expand the discussion and expand the picture into the realities of what happens on the receiving end of this.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Carolyn Reinick-Wolf.
Thank you for inviting me.
And again, I've been speaking with Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, who's a partner in the law firm of Abrahams & Fensterman, where she is the director of the firm's mental health law practice, concentrating in the areas of mental health and healthcare law. She's also the founder and president of Campus Behavioral Risk Consultants and is a former hospital administrator and director of hospital risk management. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the latest census figures on poverty in America.
Just waiting for bread. Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Pinpair, who's the author of A People's History of Poverty in America, which was the winner of the Michael Harrington Book Prize, and a professor at Columbia University School of Social Work. His forthcoming book is The Celluloid Poorhouse, 110 Years of Poverty and Homelessness in the Movies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pinpair.
Thank you, Ian. Pleasure to be here.
And the Census Bureau have just announced their 2012 findings on poverty, and they also talk about health insurance coverage and generally give us a picture, which, by the way, there was a recent study, or actually it's not come out yet, that indicated 4 out of 5 Americans experience joblessness and the threat of homelessness at least once in their lives. That report's yet to come out, but it really questioned the very nature of, or the notion that we are a middle-class country, as always, you notice President Obama always appeals to the middle class. And it may well be that we're much more of a working-class country than a middle-class country. So let's start with, in that framework, where would you put the poor?
Well, I mean, I think it's useful that you bring up what we discover if we step back and we look at poverty over time. The numbers that came out today show that at the moment that the survey the Census Bureau conducts was conducted, we have about 15% of the American population officially in poverty. That's the equivalent of about $23,000 a year for a family of four. But what that tells us is how many people are poor during the course of that survey. But one of the things that we know from other research, as you mentioned, is that large numbers, in fact, of Americans move in and out of poverty over time. So if we, say, step back and look at a three-year period, look at using Census Bureau data again from 2009 to 2011, if we ask how many people were poor for at least 2 months or more at any point over that three-year period, that's not 15%. That's closer to 32%. We're approaching a third of Americans over any given three-year period of time will find themselves poor at least once. And I think this is important in part because we I think, tend to think of poverty as long-term, persistent poverty that people face for years and years and years. That's important, and we should pay attention to that. But that's a very small portion of people who are poor in the United States. Maybe 3.5% over that three-year period were poor for the entire three-year period. So in some ways, the message here is one about persistent insecurity, not poverty, and that people who are working class 1 year may find themselves poor the next. People who are middle class may find themselves moving, particularly in periods of economic downturn, from middle class to working class to poor to very poor. And then if all goes well, may climb that back up again. But it really is, I think, useful that we step aside from these sort of point-in-time measures because that doesn't accurately give us a sense of the dynamism of moving in and out of poverty in the U.S.
But what this U.S. Census Bureau report on poverty does tell us is that 21.8% of our nation's children live in poverty, and that 57,000 low-income children have just lost their Head Start services due to sequestration. Is it true, and it seems to be the case, that of all the advanced industrial countries, the United States is the only country that is not trying to deal with poverty and reduce it and eliminate it, but in fact is creating policies that are exacerbating and increasing poverty? In other words, that we are not trying to reduce poverty, our policies, particularly in the Republican House, are increasing poverty.
It has been, as an empirical matter, true that the United States has higher levels of poverty overall, of child poverty in particular, than any other rich democracy on the planet. And that there has been some progress. If we go back to the early 1950s and look at child poverty rates, it was probably a bit higher then than it is now. But we still live in a world in which between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 American children can count on being in a poor household. It's much worse for African-American children. It winds up being closer to half. And again, if we look at that movement over time, we've got more than half, maybe two-thirds of all American children will at some point be in a poor household. And you're absolutely right. If we look at policies over the course of the last year and a half or so, particularly related to the sequester, a lot of your listeners may not quite get the sense of what the effects of the sequester have been, in part because they have been so concentrated among poor and low-income populations. We've seen rather large cuts in Head Start, which is not just about education, mind. Keep in mind that a lot of low-income families use Head Start as daycare, so that winds up having a really profound impact on low-income families' ability to work and what it costs them then to provide for child care. So you wind up driving the very families that many people would tell you they want to help, those that are working and trying very hard to support themselves, you wind up creating these awful kinds of feedback effects where you drive them deeper into poverty. Of course, at the same time in which we're slated to have a vote in the House of Representatives on a budget this week that would cut somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 billion to $80 billion out of the food stamp program over the course of the next 10 years. the benefits of which disproportionately accrue to children and to working families. So again, we've got this real disconnect between the supposed aims of a lot of the rhetoric, as you say, particularly among the majority in the House of Representatives, and the actual impact that the policies they're proposing would have. And it really is, I think, perhaps the shocking bit is that while we are looking at making things a bit worse among the poorest families, there's nothing new about this. I mean, we've had poverty rates at this level, child poverty rates at this level since the 1980s. And while we've seen fluctuation up and down over time, the reality is that every other rich democracy on the planet has figured out a way to have significantly lower poverty rates and significantly lower child poverty rates than we do, and yet we fail again and again.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Pimpare, who's the author of A People's History of Poverty in America, which was the winner of the Michael Harrington Book Prize. He's a professor at the Columbia University School of Social Work, and his forthcoming book is The Celluloid Poorhouse, 110 Years of Poverty and Homelessness in the Movies. Now, one of the House Republicans who is pushing for this big cut in food stamps, the so-called SNAP program, which feeds the poor families and particularly children, he is also the biggest recipient of farm aid, which is right-wing welfare in the state of Tennessee. And so is this indicative of, as you have pointed out, that poverty is not a policy problem, it's a political problem? And is this to say that because our politics have been captured by the wealthy, that America is taking care of the wealthy, these wealthy farmers, this wealthy farmer in Tennessee who gets enormous crop subsidies from the federal government, he's the one who's trying to literally impoverish and starve children in this country? It's mind-boggling.
Well, we don't, you know, we don't even have to necessarily go so far as to wonder whether if the intent here isn't to do physical harm, but I think we can do what I don't think we do often enough, which is to think about the who is it who benefits from high unemployment rates, from high poverty rates, from weakened access to food stamps, to weakened access to disability programs. And if we look around the world, one of the things that we notice is that those nations with much more elaborate welfare states have higher wages. And part of that is because if you live in a world in which there are good social supports available to you, if there are good unemployment insurance programs, good access to health care, good access to cash assistance programs, good access to housing subsidies, what that means is that if you find yourself unemployed, you've got a little bit of money that makes it possible for you to survive so that you can turn down genuinely dreadful job offers that offer you low wages and lack of upward mobility and don't provide security. If you live in a world in which you can't get food stamps and you can't get unemployment insurance and the minimum wage has been stagnant since the late 1960s, that very much works to the benefit of employers. If you have a desperate, scared workforce, they will take whatever job is available at whatever wage you offer to them because there's no better option available. Right? This is something the U.S. Chamber of Commerce knew during welfare reform debates in the 1960s. There was a member of the United States Chamber present at every congressional hearing around welfare reform. What on earth does the United States Chamber of Commerce care about welfare reform? Because one of the consequences of welfare reform in 1996 was somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 million additional low-skill, less-educated workers being pushed out into the labor market, which, given what we know about basic principles of supply and demand, tends up driving down wages. So I don't think we necessarily have to think of House members as being sociopaths, but that we can think of as engaging in a rational effort to pursue the interest of their electoral benefactors.
So then, given that these new cuts that are being proposed in the House on top of cuts of 18.6% in the Department of Labor, Health and Human Services and Education.
Yeah.
This $45 billion could be up to $80 billion in the food stamps. They're also cutting funds for meals for homebound seniors, vocational training programs for those who've lost their jobs, and food, as we've said, under the SNAP program. And they're also going after disability insurance. And frankly, there may well be some fraud and abuse in that arena, but there's no fraud and abuse in food stamps, or if there is, it's negligible.
And for that matter, none. That there was a recent GAO, General Accountability Office, a government monitoring agency report on the SSDI, the disability program, and they were actually unable to identify any documented fraud. What they did find was that the Bureau wasn't sufficiently staffed to keep up with the paperwork that was coming in, so there may have been some instances of benefits being granted that shouldn't have, but that wasn't people trying to dishonestly get benefits. It's the bureaucracy not being well funded enough to monitor the program. But no evidence of fraud and abuse in food stamps or in disability programs. In fact, they have some of the lowest levels of improper payments of any programs that the United States government runs.
Well, Stephen Pinpair, one of the surreal things about the way our government is, in the sense that it's captured, it's by and for the 1%. Is the Department of Agriculture, who also have jurisdiction over food stamps, they also have jurisdiction over the commodities and trading futures market. And as you know, through the Goldman Sachs Index, so much money on Wall Street is gaming the price of gasoline, which is way up now because of a fear over a war with Syria. But you might have noticed it hasn't come down now that that fear of war has gone away, or at least been reduced. And they also game the price of food. So you have this surreal situation where Wall Street is making billions out of making food more expensive and gasoline more expensive, two basic things that working Americans need and have to pay for, at the same time that the Department of Agriculture is turning a blind eye to this activity on Wall Street. They're going after poor people. I mean, I guess it's a loaded question here, but it seems to me that the people who control or direct our government are the ones who are making money, and that all of the people we talk about who are going to be losing meals, the homebound seniors, the vocational training programs, and the poor people who need food for their kids, they simply don't have a political constituency.
There are a couple of scholars who have done some sort of fairly elaborate, sophisticated studies on trying to get at this question of who is Congress, in fact, responsive to. One guy called Larry Bartels and another called Martin Dillons, one at University of Virginia and the other at Princeton, I believe. And they both wind up coming to essentially the same conclusion, which is that not only is the American federal government looking at the last 15 to 20 years in particular unresponsive to the needs of poor and low-income people, but in fact increasingly unresponsive to the needs of middle-class Americans as well. And these are sort of fairly elaborate, sophisticated studies that really do look for expressed needs and desires across the population and try to gauge how likely is it that Congress will respond depending upon who it is that pleads their case. And that, you know, the sort of the rhetoric that people have used for a long time now about the American political system being captured really is a verifiable empirical reality. And in fact, we can see that the larger the percentage of wealthy Americans who support a particular kind of policy, the increased likelihood that that policy will be enacted by Congress. It's not a guarantee because it's a complicated system and there are lots of pieces at work there. But all else equal, the more rich people are in support of a particular policy, the more likely it is to be enacted by the national government. What we find by contrast when we look at the expressed desires of low-income, poor, and middle-income people is that there is absolutely no correlation whatsoever between the number of people in those population groups who support a particular policy and the likelihood that that's going to be enacted. And that, to me, indicates that the poverty problem is a problem that reflects a much larger problem of democracy. And I think that it is curious happenstance that today is not only the release of the new poverty data, but the Constitution Day, the anniversary of the ratification of the U.S. Constitution, and the second anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. I think they all tend to be pointing toward this fundamental problem in the dysfunction of the American political system. And some of this is because we've got an unusually complicated system, right? People will remember this from their cigarettes, the divided institutions, checks and balances, federalism. But in some ways, we created a political system that is on a regular basis at war with itself, particularly if different parties control different pieces. But it makes it extraordinarily difficult to get anything done and creates spaces for particularly well-placed, well-funded interest groups to have influence in that lawmaking process in a way that is simply not the case in other kinds of parliamentary political systems. So this really is the shape of our political institutions that opens up opportunities for rent-seeking interest groups, for people out for their own particular kinds of interests. This has gotten worse over time and has been exacerbated of late because there's so much money in the campaign system itself, right? We live in a world in which 46 million people are getting by on less than the equivalent of $23,000 a year for a family of four. Meanwhile, yesterday or the day before, Forbes released its 400 wealthiest Americans list that show that there are 400 Americans worth collectively a total of $2 trillion. That's I think, more than the GDP of Russia. And that the average net worth of just those 400 individuals is $5 billion. That's not the economy at work. Those are political decisions. That's changes in tax policy. That's changes in regulation. Those are a movement away from the much more broad-based sort of tax system we had in the immediate post-war period, from, say, the 40s to the 70s. But since the 70s, on steroids since the Reagan administration, we've consistently withdrawn taxation on wealthiest individuals and corporations, as well as withdrawing regulation, while we've allowed the value of social welfare benefits to erode, while we've allowed the minimum wage to erode, while we have in fact created the conditions not just for this inequality, but for stagnant well-being across the majority of the population. Right? That's increasingly, I think, a problem of healthy functioning democracy, that it can so poorly respond to the needs of so many for the benefit of the few.
So just in closing, Stephen Pimper, just in the last minute here, given that there are 46 million Americans living in poverty, that's 15% of the population that's impoverished, what data is there to indicate whether or not these people vote?
Well, we've got all sorts of surveys going on over time, and it's a good question because all else equal, the population who is least likely to vote are low-income, less-educated Americans. And that's absolutely a piece of the puzzle, right? If you're a member of the House or the Senate, you need two things in order to maintain office, right? You need campaign contributions in order to run your next election, and you need votes. If, in fact, low-income people can't be counted on for campaign contributions for the obvious reasons and are less likely to vote, there is an extent to which it's entirely rational that their needs be ignored. They can be.
Well, Stephen Pimper, I thank you so much for joining us here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pimper, who's the author of A People's History of Poverty in America, which was the winner of the Michael Harrington Book Prize. He's a professor at the Columbia University School of Social Work, and his forthcoming book is The Celluloid Poorhouse, 110 Years of Poverty and Homelessness in the Movies. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.